Live from the Carter Subaru Studio, this is the Jason Rantz Show. If you want to join the conversation, go online to CairoRadio.com. Click on that Linwood Honda inbox, search for the name Jason Rantz, or of course you can go to Facebook.com/Jason Rantz Show, R-A-N-T-Z. It's all one word. I want to talk about something. People hate Gwyneth Paltrow, not just dislike, but they seem to hate her, this innocent, seemingly sweet actress, for whatever reason. She always seems to generate intense snark.
If I could give you the world on a silver platter, would it even matter? You'd still be mad.
They will always be mad at Gwyneth Paltrow, no matter what she does, no matter what she goes through. Whether it's a divorce or maybe a bad acting job in a movie. People are just absolute haters. They are utter haters.
Hate on me, hater. Now or later. Cause I'm gonna do me. You'll be mad, baby.
They are just a bunch of haters. Thank you, Jill Scott. Earlier in the week, we learned that Gwyneth Paltrow was divorcing her husband, Chris Martin, the lead singer of Coldplay. But she's not calling it a divorce. She's calling it, quote unquote, conscious uncoupling. The term was coined by a Los Angeles therapist and author, Catherine Woodward Thomas. Her website describes her as a creator of conscious uncoupling process to quote, release the trauma of a breakup and reinvent your life. And Gwyneth Paltrow was absolutely mocked for it. Absolutely mocked. The Guardian called her a deluded tosh. Twitter went crazy making fun of her. TMZ mocked her. They just are so mean to her. If she wants to use this term for something that she's going through, something reasonably painful, let her use that term, conscious uncoupling, to release the trauma of a breakup and reinvent your life. Doesn't that sound healthy? Yeah, it sounds a little Malibu. It sounds a little New Age. But isn't that what a lot of people want to do when they're going through a divorce, which is just to get rid of all the bad energy, all that negativity, and just restart? All the baggage from a marriage that unfortunately failed, all the baggage that came with that, to just let it go, to release it, and reinvent your life and start over in some respects so you're no longer going to be damaged by some of that bad energy. That sounds like a good, healthy process. And so people mock Gwyneth Paltrow for it, and now some working moms are on the attack. In an interview with E! Magazine or ETV, she said of parenting this, "It's much harder for me. I feel like I set it up in a way that makes it difficult because for me, like if I miss a school run, they're all like, where were you? I don't like to be the lead so I don't have to work every day, you know. I have little things that I like, and obviously I want it to be good and challenging and interesting and be with good people and that kind of thing." And here's what she added, and here's what people are getting really, really upset about. "I think it's different when you have an office job because it's routine and, you know, you can do all the stuff in the morning and then you can come home in the evening. When you're shooting a movie, they're like, we need you to go to Wisconsin for 2 weeks and then you work 14 hours a day and that part of it is very difficult. I think to have a regular job and be a mom is not as, of course there are challenges, but it's not like being on set." And so people ripped her. People ripped her as a A-lister who has no understanding of reality. People ripped her as someone who is so out of touch with working moms and the reality of what it is like for millions and millions and millions of working moms in this country. And there was this letter, this open letter to Gwyneth Paltrow on the New York Post. It was written by Mackenzie Dawson. It was just an utterly scathing letter. Just completely mocking Gwyneth Paltrow, completely mocking this idea that she has it hard, saying filming movies once a year is really, really easy. And by the way, because you're rich, you don't have to worry about childcare anymore. So they were just ripping her. And I want to talk just briefly about this idea that filming a movie is really easy. Now, it is very rewarding. It is something that you do rather intensely for just maybe a couple weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe a few months, and then you get a lot of money, yeah. But it's not easy. It's grueling work. It is long days. It is intensely stressful. I mean, think about it. You're talking about some investor putting potentially millions and millions of dollars in a movie that you're in, and it is mostly or partially your responsibility to help make sure people actually go see that movie. So if you are the star Gwyneth Paltrow in a movie, and they're saying, hey, you know what, we're going to invest millions of dollars in this movie because we think you're going to be able to get people in the seats at the theater, and that doesn't work, that's intentionally, insanely stressful. And so imagine from that perspective as you're filming this movie, having all that baggage on top of you. Oh, and by the way, you're generally speaking in another country or in another state, far away from your kid, not being able to have that kind of relationship with them, at least for the 2 to several weeks that you're away. Having to parent over Skype or over FaceTime on your iPhone. It's not easy. So at least in the cases of people who are working in offices, you do not necessarily or routinely have to leave the country often to do a film shoot. Yes, it is just as tough sometimes for you when you're at work as it is for Gwyneth Paltrow on the set of a movie. There's no doubt about that. Being a mom is really, really tough work when you are also working. When you're not working, it's really, really tough. But at least you get to come home at night and spend some time with your kid. Gwyneth Paltrow doesn't always get to do that. She's got a lot of stuff going on. And all of the attacks on Gwyneth, we're on a first name basis now. All of these attacks just seem so way over the top. And I've come to the decision that people are mad at her, that people dislike her for a really, really basic reason. Jealousy. I sense they dislike that she's pretty, that she's talented, that she seems to have the world at her fingertips. And it's the type of venom that seems uniquely female in a way. We're always told that women don't usually become really, really close friends because they are especially vicious. I don't know if that's true, but I look at something like this because I'm only really seeing women constantly bagging on Gwyneth Paltrow. I don't see men reacting to Gwyneth Paltrow this way. I don't see men reacting to other men this way. And as a man, I can confidently say that I support her. I see her perspective. I'm actually pretty inspired by her. She lives a mindful life. She seems to always have a great attitude. She seems like an awesome mom. And yes, she's clearly talented. She's inspirational. And you know what? She never complains about all the haters. And there are plenty. And like she said in her movie, she's country strong.
'Cause I'm country strong.
She is hard to break. Like the ground she grew up on. Now you may be able to fool her. And she may fall. But she's not going to stay down long. You want to know why? She's country strong.
Country strong.
We're back in 4 minutes on the Jason Rance Show.
I have a weather, cold winter, longer summer without a drop of rain. Push me in a corner and I'll come out fighting. I may lose, but I'll always keep my.
Welcome back to the Jason Rance Show. Join the conversation online. CairoRadio.com. Click on that Linwood Honda inbox. Search for my name. Plus, you can always go to Facebook.com/Jason Rance Show. We post a lot of stuff of what's going on behind the scenes, and we'll get that Gwyneth Paltrow defense podcasted and placed up hopefully by the end of the night, because I know a lot of people want to hear me talk through Country Strong once more.
I'm probably going to go back and listen to it myself.
Right?
It was probably the most entertaining thing we've done all week.
I don't know how to take that, so I'm just...
I'm a big fan of you speaking lyrics,
okay,
I guess.
As the March 31st deadline to sign up for health insurance approaches, Washington State's online exchange has enrolled more than 125,000 in Obamacare insurance plans, but there's a little bit of a problem. This week, the Washington Health Benefit Exchange, with which runs the Washington Health Plan Finder website, it disclosed that approximately 11,500 applications were quote-unquote stuck, a result of technological problems, missing information, income tax issues. That number was down from 15,000 at the end of February, and that means it's rather unlikely that these folks will be cleared before the deadline of the 31st. In Washington State, applicants must get insurance done before 11:59 p.m. Monday night, unless technical issues prevent them from completing that process. The state said it would grant more time to those people on a case-by-case basis. The cases of stuck applications are small in number, but show the kinds of problems that people can run into. And these snags have been incredibly frustrating. Producer Mac has been on this show multiple times talking about the fact that he spent nearly 3 weeks and countless phone calls trying to fix a technical error that was happening during his enrollment in the program. And only till we came on the air and actually talked to someone from Washington Health Plan Finder did he get signed up for his insurance. And here's the thing. Callers still have to wait an average of more than a minute just to go through an initial sorting process, then another 49 minutes to get through to a specialty queue and talk to people who might be able to solve their problem. So it takes you about 50 minutes before you actually start talking to a human being. And then it probably takes another, I don't know, on the liberal side, let's say 20 minutes, 30 minutes. On the conservative side, let's say 10 minutes. So it'll take you about an hour to sign up. And I know that a lot of people who are being forced to go through Obamacare, not necessarily wanting to do it, definitely can't wait to spend an hour on hold talking to people about this program that they don't want. And Mac's experience was not a singular experience. Ryan O'Keefe is 31. He lives in Seattle. He's self-employed. He's a mortgage broker. And the Seattle Times highlighted his experience. He moved to Seattle from California last year, began his application when the exchange opened for business in October. There was a delay initially because his wife was still in California. He finally got his wife added to a selected plan, and he made his first payment on January 6th. And then he says that's when things began to unravel. He received a letter at the end of December or beginning of January indicating the application had been stuck, but that as long as everything was completed and paid for by January 15th, they would backdate the coverage to January 1st. Awesome. He said that's the last he heard. He does know that the coverage didn't start on January 1st. He said he had signed up for a gold plan, but when he called the exchange to confirm payment for March, he was told that his plan had been changed to a bronze plan. He says, I'd never requested that. I think I've spent 11 hours on the phone with the exchange over the last 2 months. I told them that needed to be fixed. According to this man, the day after he inquired about the change to bronze, his health plan was canceled. He had no idea why. He said he was told initially that there was a glitch in the system. More recently, he was informed that he was ineligible because he and his wife couldn't prove their citizenship. Well, they've always been citizens of this country. He is not alone in these experiences. There are people not just in Washington, but across this country who still cannot sign up for Obamacare due to technical issues. And here's the thing, even though I'm clearly not a fan of Obamacare, if you're going to make a program, if you're going to force people to sign up, it is imperative that you make it as easy as humanly possible. If you're going to force us to sign up for something, or conversely, if you're going to give a program that people want and you've promised them and they're excited about signing up, you have the duty to make sure that this website operates correctly. This is embarrassing. This is utterly embarrassing that a few days before the mandatory deadline for people to sign up for Obamacare, they can't even get through. They're still waiting 50 minutes minimum in Washington State. You've got folks in Oregon having mailed applications for Obamacare sent to them because the website doesn't work. And a lot of people are thinking, well, part of the reason that they're doing this extended deadline for some people with tech issues is because there's a lot of them. And these are, of course, the tech issues that we know about. Because, as you know, trying to get numbers, hard numbers from the Obama administration on Obamacare is incredibly difficult. Like, out of those 6 million that you say signed up, how many paid? How many didn't have insurance prior? How many of that number is from Medicare and Medicaid? You don't know. Well, on Monday, people will know. By the way, on Sunday, I will be joining the Cairo radio crew right here from noon to 2 with extended coverage of the Oso mudslide and the efforts happening over the weekend, so please check that out. But in 4 minutes, Tom Tangney's going to stop by to review the film Noah. It's the Jason Rant Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rant Show. As always, Friday nights at 9:30. Joining me in studio is Tom Tangney, even though he is sick as a dog. I forced him to come do this segment. What's wrong with you?
I'm not sick as a dog. I just have a bad cold, and it's really been kicking my butt all week.
You don't sound the same, but you still have the same energy. And of course, despite being sick, you still got a chance to go see a movie. Of course, every Friday night we talk about the big movie of the weekend, and this weekend it's Noah.
My father said that one day, if man continued in his ways, the Creator would annihilate this world.
Can it not be averted?
He speaks to you. You must trust that he speaks in a way that you can understand.
I saw water. Death by water. That's on your life.
A great flood is coming. We build a vessel to survive the storm. We build an ark.
So it sounds pretty exciting. Is it good?
Well, the thing is, the line I've been using is that Noah has a hard time staying afloat. I think it's very ambitious, but it's also very unwieldy. It's a biblical epic like you've never seen before in terms of the special effects, but it's also a biblical epic that you've never seen before in terms of its psychodrama. It's really an interesting take, and I guess it's nothing to be surprised about, knowing the director, Darren Aronofsky, is the guy responsible for this. He's been dreaming about this since he wrote an award-winning poem in the third grade, he tells us. He won some class prize for writing a poem about Noah, and this has been one of his obsessions his entire life. This is a guy who makes very different kinds of movies, started off making very kind of small indie movies like Pie.
Requiem for a Dream,
fantastic movies. Most recently, he did The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke, and Black Swan got a lot of attention, mm-hmm. Won a number of Oscars and the like, and so now he's taking on the biblical epic. The reason I think it's unwieldy and it doesn't finally work, despite its ambition, is that he tries to do too many things. It's like this mishmash of too many things. I already mentioned, like, there's Noah has this kind of psychodrama going on for a good third of the film. At the same time, you've got some of the best special effects. That arc is really an impressive sight to see. And it's basically built on the dimensions mentioned in the Bible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's biblically the most accurate vessel we've ever seen in the movies. As an arc. The thing is, it's not the way we think of arcs. Arcs are not like sailing ships. They do not have nice bows and bows and all these kinds of stuff. I mean, the thing is that it's really just a big, long box.
It's supposed to just float.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's not meant to have to go anywhere. Directed, it just is supposed to be able to, you know, be buffeted by the waves and the winds and the rains and just, you know, stay intact. And that it does. So that's very impressive. They actually built the first, like, 50 feet of it. And it's I think it's about 50 feet high as well. And then they CGI'd the back 150 feet, but it is an mm-hmm. enormous thing. And also the CGI effects of the animals are really impressive. They decide, as long as they get to have two of every animal, they decide they're going to go for not just your standard, your elephants and your giraffes and your tigers. I mean, they have hundreds of creatures that they said may not even have existed. They allowed their imagination to run wild. And there's a great scene where all the birds swoop in up into the upper level. Then all the four-legged creatures all come in. And it's really an impressive visual feat. And then finally, you got the reptiles and the snakes and the insects and all that reaching in. And it's really impressive to see them boarding the ark. A problem, though, though, with the movie, in terms of that, and that's its strength, by the way, is that that's once you see the arc initially, they don't really do much more with it. And even more surprising, once you see all the animals enter, they don't do anything with the animals inside. One of the things is that one of the problems about the source, the Bible, is they don't tell you a lot of stuff about what goes on that arc when once it's, you know, at sea.
It's a very small portion of the Bible. We're not talking about pages upon pages upon pages.
It's
We're
not
talking
even
about a small amount of text.
It's like a sliver of a text. It's not even a short story length. Yeah. It's just basically this happened and that happened.
It's a plot line.
Which gives the creators, the filmmakers, carte blanche to invent all sorts of stuff. And I don't want to get into too much of the few pieces of information that they do give you. They do give him an antagonist before he gets on the arc named Tubal Cain, played by Ray Winston, who's a fantastic actor. And there's a lot of there's a lot of military fighting and the like, and you've got sort of these CGI rock monsters that also get involved. It's a very kind of fantasy world at the same time that it's a very hard, there's sort of this hard scrabble realism to it too. So it's an interesting mix. But the main dilemma of the movie, and this really caught me off guard, it surprised me. A lot of people probably never heard the name Soren Kierkegaard, but he is a fantastic 19th century, early 20th century, a Danish Christian philosopher. And he has this great analysis of Abraham and the crisis of faith that Abraham has to grapple with when he is told to kill his son. Because everything about the way he thinks morality should be is to certainly not kill your son, but God is commanding him to kill his son. And the philosopher Kierkegaard does this great job of analyzing what that really means when you're a man of faith. He actually, Darren Aronofsky, takes that dilemma and puts it into Noah's world. So he has to do something that seems immoral on our level and yet seems to be a command from God. That grappling with it, that is a really daring for a mainstream movie to have that kind of issue, the extremity to which faith could push you. It's really an interesting issue. The problem is, I'm not going to say more about it, except that the resolution is so lame. It, like, why even bring it up if you don't really have an interesting resolution to it?
Well, and if you're wanting to go into this movie without any sort of understanding as to what the plot line is, tune out for just about 2 minutes, because I want to bring up something that we've learned about this film.
Okay.
And it goes to a little bit of the criticism coming from people in the religious sectors saying that it's not true to the actual text. And even though the text is so small, there is one really kind of pivotal point in this story, which is the sons of Noah in the text have wives. And so in this, they do not have wives. And I presume that means for Noah, he's wondering how exactly does mankind survive if he doesn't have sons with wives and they can't repopulate.
That's really interesting, because there is one of the sons has a woman, has a connection. Now, I don't know when they become officially wives, but that is really one of the linchpins of the plot, is the fact that one of the sons doesn't have a woman to help propagate the earth with. And that's, we all know, that's the one thing we know about the ending of the Noah story is, you know, be fruitful and multiply. So that is a curious, and it would be interesting to find out why they decided to do that, because that's one of the dilemmas. One of the sons realizes, I'm getting on that arc, and if they really wipe out the world, I need a woman friend. And he goes off and he has a clash with his father. So basically, I think that's, I really praise the movie for its ambition. I think it's not like any other biblical epic you're going to see, but I do think that it's a noble failure, maybe, or maybe the ambition, reaches further than his grasp and the like. I think there are reasons to admire this movie, but I don't think it ultimately works, despite the fact that I think Russell Crowe is fantastic in the movie. He is a great, very serious, earnest, hard patriarch. I mean, he's very good in this role.
How about Jennifer Connelly?
I found her role, I don't blame her, I found her role not interesting. She basically plays the human component of this family, and so good for her. She wants to defend her son. She wants her Noah to do, you know, the more generous stuff. But it's a pretty standard role. I think just about any actress in Hollywood could probably pulled off that role. So not an interesting role, unfortunately.
And of course, we also have Anthony Hopkins. We have Emma Watson. We have Logan Lerman. So on paper, the cast sounds really, really good.
Emma Watson has a much bigger and more crucial role than I think most of us realize going into the movie. Anthony Hopkins, he comes out of the kind of the fantasy world. It felt like he was an extra from Lord of the Rings. He plays Methuselah, you know, the oldest man in the book, and he has this kind of magical touch. There's a strain of magical realism that really kind of throws you off guard, because so much of the movie is, you know, down to earth, almost despairingly bleak realism.
Nick Nolte's in this. Does he play a drunk? Like he's been playing in almost every single one of his
movies. He's the voice behind one of these. They call them watchers. Mm-hmm. They're fallen angels that end up protecting Noah from the hordes of men ruled by Tubal Cain. So his voice is there, but his body isn't.
So in the next, we only have about 3 minutes left. Let's talk about a new movie that is out on DVD and Blu-ray. It's The Wolf of Wall Street.
Act like what we're getting. Okay, wait, he's coming. He's coming.
Hey, so I think if we short Pfizer,
$430,000? In 1 month, Jordy? Huh?
They're business expenses. Yes.
Jordy, look what you got here.
What?
Look at this. $26,000 for one dinner.
No. This could be explained. Dad, we had clients. We had Pfizer clients.
Right. The porterhouse from Argentina.
The expensive champagne and the wine. We had to buy champagne. And you ordered all the sides. Tell them about the sides.
I ordered
you
the sides. So
sides?
Yeah.
Sides? $26,000 worth of sides? What are these sides? They cure cancer?
The sides did cure cancer. That's the problem. They were there. That's why they were expensive.
Shut up.
I'm serious. I know.
Stop.
I love The Wolf of Wall Street. It's, of course, directed by Martin Scorsese. It stars Leonardo DiCaprio. It stars in probably his defining role, to define him as this great character actor, Jonah Hill.
Yep.
Which you never expected this kind of acting coming from the guy who was in all those silly teen movies.
Yeah, well, Superbad, which Superbad, is not a silly teen movie, but
on paper you would say you don't expect him to be really, really good in a Martin Scorsese movie. And of course, Matthew McConaughey, who's in the movie for maybe 6.5 minutes, but is incredibly powerful. This film is the definition of its subject matter. The subject matter being excess and greed. That's what this film is. It clocks in at just over 3 hours. It doesn't feel like 3 hours because the energy of this film is so fast, so fast paced.
We don't always agree, but I am so on the same page with you about this movie. I love this movie. It made my top 10. It was, I know the one little quibble we have, I actually preferred it to American Hustle. American Hustle tends to have a little bit more critical acclaim than this movie. I was really thrown by this movie because I was expecting, listen, I've seen Scorsese work with Leonardo DiCaprio too many times. I didn't need to see this. And man, I think this is the best role I've ever seen Leonardo DiCaprio do. And it is so, to think how old Martin Scorsese is, how much vigorous life is in this movie. It could have been directed by a 30-year-old.
I get so annoyed with how Leonardo DiCaprio is treated by the quote-unquote Hollywood establishment and even moviegoers. I feel like he's underrated, and I understand that everyone knows the name Leonardo DiCaprio, but he has reached that A-list status where you stop thinking about the roles that he plays and just thinks about it's Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, it's the celebrity. Yeah.
And so he is equated at this point with how like Arnold Schwarzenegger was equated at one point in his career. And the difference there clearly is Arnold can't act. Leonardo DiCaprio is this brilliant actor, and he does something that Tom Cruise can do really effectively, which is take on a character and you stop thinking about them as Tom Cruise or Leonardo DiCaprio or for a lot of points, Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
They've just taken on roles so effectively and they are so good at it. You really get absorbed in their character and in their story and you forget that they're this A-list celebrity. But I don't think people treat him with the amount of respect that he deserves based on this, based on The Aviator. I mean, he is such a great actor. What was the mob movie? I always forget the name of, with Martin Scorsese, Jack Nicholson. Come on.
Oh, Departed?
Departed. Oh. I mean, he is just so good.
Yeah, and he was just part of the ensemble in that.
Yeah.
This really is his movie. He's in just about every frame of this. One thing I think we might as well point out, because I've been taken aback by a number of people who have talked to me about seeing this movie, and they told me that they were unprepared for the amount of sex.
Lots of sex.
Drugs, nudity. I mean, it's out there. And the thing is, I just kind of laugh because I guess it didn't surprise me. This is, like you said, this is a movie about the age of excess. And yes, he excessively does all of those activities.
It's done.
That's what life was like.
It's done very mindfully in this film. And that's really what I like about this more than any Martin Scorsese film in the last 5 years or so. This one seems very deliberate in its delivery of the content. And so, Noah, you're saying, kind of pass, but it's got some pluses.
I give it credit for effort.
And The Wolf of Wall Street, both of us very, very strongly recommend you watch if you are of age, because, again, there's a lot of sex.
It's a hard R.
It's a very, very hard R. Tom Tangney, thank you so much for stopping by.
Happy.
It's the Jason Rand Show on Cairo Radio. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. If you want to join the conversation, go online, CairoRadio.com. Click on that Linwood Honda inbox and search for the name Jason Rantz. Or, of course, you can go to Facebook.com/ Jason Rantz Show, RANTZ. It is all one word. Let's take a field trip. Let's go to the city of Pasadena, which is about 5 minutes north of downtown L.A. Unless you're in traffic, of course, then it's about 30 to 45 minutes north of Los Angeles. And in Pasadena, LGBT student activists and administrators at Pasadena City College are up in arms over the fact that a Chick-fil-A is opening up nearby campus. Chick-fil-A, as you probably remember, came under fire from the LGBT community in, 2012, when Chief Operating Officer Dan Cathy came out in opposition to same-sex marriage, and that obviously sparked some controversy and nationwide protests, with many calling Chick-fil-A a hate group simply because Dan Cathy was against same-sex marriage. And he took that position based on his religious beliefs. Chick-fil-A is a religious organization. I'm pretty sure they're closed on Sundays. They are basically made up, in the management section at least, of people who are informed by their religious beliefs, their Christian religious beliefs. And so Chick-fil-A went to the city council in Pasadena to apply for permits to build this Chick-fil-A. It's actually going to be in place of a Burger King that used to be there, but they wanted to do some updates to the building. They wanted to expand the drive-through and whatnot, so they had to go in and get all these permits. And obviously the city council decided to open up this whole process to the community. That is standard. And there were people from PCC, from Pasadena City College, who came down there to express their opposition to Chick-fil-A moving in nearby. And during the hearing, a student trustee from PCC named Simon Frazier, he testified on behalf of the school's LGBT community. He argued that it would cause distress for gay students in Pasadena if Chick-fil-A ended up opening nearby campus. And for their part, Chick-fil-A developer supervisor Jennifer Daw, she said that the Chick-fil-A would actually help the community. And she argued that it would help the community by providing basically between 50 and 60 new full-time and part-time jobs in the area. And it would improve the aesthetics of the location. And by a vote of 3-2, Chick-fil-A, this permit was approved for them. And that made Simon Frazier upset. This is what he's quoted as saying. I'm exceptionally disappointed. I'm deeply concerned that every concern that I raised and every PCC student that was here raised fell completely on deaf ears. That is absolutely absurd, but it is a very uniquely selfish and Generation Y problem to have, a Generation Y complaint to have. Because this idea that if you do not get your way, they clearly didn't listen to you because you are so smart and so determined with your viewpoint and so passionate that they, of course, will have to understand where you're coming from. And if they don't, well, then that's bad on them. LGBT students also voiced their concerns with having a Chick-fil-A nearby. A student by the name of Bernard Noy said, "For me, Chick-fil-A is more than a corporation expressing their opinion. For me, it is a symbol that has supported organizations that tell me that I should not be happy with who I am. I fear for my friends. They already live stressful lives. This could push them over the edge. With respect, if a Chick-fil-A can push someone over the edge, You really need, and I say this seriously, you need to seek help for that person. That is not a rational or reasonable response. It is okay for people to disagree on the topic of same-sex marriage. It is okay to disagree on a number of topics. You have to be open to people disagreeing with you. You cannot go over the edge because people disagree with you. You should engage them. If you think they are wrong, and I tend to agree, I'm in favor of gay marriage. If you think that that's what they need to support, then have conversations with them. But we shouldn't be going around closing businesses and dispermitting businesses from opening simply based on their religious beliefs or their political opinions. That's damaging. This is the Jason Rand Show. Coast to Coast is up next.